Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Sunday Brunch here on Monocle 24 with me, Juliet Foster. On today's show...
In Paris, there were 1,263 deaths from influenza last week.
The audio project commemorating 100 years since the Spanish flu. We'll meet the French-Lebanese composer and violinist Laila Shaker and...
You still hear people saying, we want our employees to be proud of what they do, to be proud to work here. But they don't actually unpick it to see why would you be proud of working somewhere? Why would I be proud? There are very different motivations.
How to keep satisfied in your job. And Marie Billon will go through the weekend newspapers. Plus, we try some rare chocolate from Ecuador. All that to come this hour live from London with me, Juliet Foster, on Monocle 24. Now, to begin today's radio show, 2018. Well, it marks the 100th anniversary of the 1918 influenza pandemic, one of the deadliest outbreaks of the disease in world history. Nicknamed Spanish flu because the press coverage increased when the virus reached Spain, the disease infected 500 million people and killed between 50 and 100 million. Since that time, the world has battled other pandemics and commemorated the victims. Yet the suffering of those affected by the 1918 flu have been largely overlooked. Well, that's about to change, thanks to the artist Jordan Baseman, whose new work, Radio Influenza, is a digital installation recalling the everyday experience of the flu through a series of soundtracks. I'm delighted to say that Jordan now joins me in the studio, but before we hear from him, let's listen to an extract from Radio Influenza.
In Paris, there were 1,263 deaths from influenza last week. Miss Tacon, daughter of Sir Thomas and Lady Tacon, died from influenza on Wednesday. She was quite well on Sunday.
Sergeant O'Weil, of the U.S. Army, died at Thetford from an overdose of aspirin while suffering from influenza. Signs that the influenza epidemic has passed the worst point are reported from many parts of the world, though the malady, apparently, has far from completed its course.
Jordan, the thing which I found really chilling about this podcast was the bluntness of the facts, and that this was not an illness that hit people because they were poor. It was a leveler. Everybody was vulnerable.
That's true. Everybody was vulnerable. It affected every aspect and every strata of society.
And the sense of panic as well, because listening to some of the other podcasts touching on very sensitive issues, for example, there were shortages of food, there was a potato shortage in London, and even concerns about whether a general election should be called because of people being together.
It was definitely a desperate time, for sure.
And from the research that you've done, I mean, were you surprised about this? Because it does appear to be one of the neglected areas of history, doesn't it?
I think what's amazing about it, because the research is all done on the British newspaper archive, that the daily living with influenza got lost, and now that's being retold.
So the coverage of the time, from what you unearthed, was more about the fact so many people affected as opposed to the human side of it, what it was doing to families, how it was destroying communities.
It was both, I think. Because it was so devastating, there are a lot of statistics attached to it, but also the newspaper articles do reflect individual stories and individual families dealing with trauma and the difficulty of having flu.
Because if you didn't know that it was talking about 1918 to 1919, because that was the year when it raged, you would have felt that perhaps they were talking about the Black Death, because again, one of your examples came across children and families who couldn't be buried because the undertakers refused to handle the bodies. Some of the bodies were actually sent back to the families.
It wasn't that they refused to handle bodies. It's just that there weren't enough people around to bury them.
Because they themselves had died.
Well, also because of the First World War. Set within the context of the First World War, the flu was devastating on top of already a devastated environment. So there just weren't the people around to bury the bodies.
Why do you think that the pandemic isn't really talked about that much, just from your own personal perspective?
After reading the articles and researching a bit, I think part of it was that at that time there was so much going on. There was so much that was difficult in the world. After the First World War in London, and England was a devastated place, and just rebuilding and getting on with life took over. And I think the daily day-to-day aspects of living with that illness was lost.
Mm. Because you've got the confluence of two things happening. On the one hand, you've got the end of the First World War. So there's the relief that the conflict is over and that troops are coming home. But the troops themselves were also carriers because, again, they were travelling together, coming home. They didn't know.
That's right. And I think at the time, there was still a lot of speculation as to what was the cause of the flu and how it was transmitted. So people did know that they shouldn't congregate in public places. But then again, there were tens of thousands of people moving all over the world coming home. So it was a difficult time.
Mm. And we have to stress as well that this was worldwide. And again, you've reflected this in the work because you haven't just looked at the experience of people in Britain, in the United States, but even further afield in Africa, and how people dealt with it, this concern that perhaps it started in the animal kingdom and somehow leaped into humanity.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that the project is very local, it's very national, it's very international, and it's totally global in terms of the way that it talks about the spread of disease and illness.
Mm. And certainly some of the theories as well, because one theory was put forward that if you were Jewish or a vegetarian, you were safer because you didn't eat pork, and pork was seen as a source of the flu.
I think a lot of that is because there's a lot of articles about bad bacon, and bacon is a big issue because there was just not that much food around, and there weren't that many fats to eat, and everything was rationed. And then there was all the speculation that the flu was caused by bad bacon, people eating bad meat, and there were some not very nice ideas floating around that accompanied that.
Mm. And what about the cures that were being advocated?
The cures are, well, people didn't really know what the cures were. They just staying in bed, getting rest, sleep, not going to work. But that was often quite difficult for people because they had to work. And often the principal care would be someone who was ill with flu, so they couldn't stop looking after people. It was very complicated.
Hmm. And it's a huge subject. And just to get some background on this, you were commissioned by the biomedical charity Wellcome to produce a work commemorating this event. And from a personal perspective, I would really like to know why you took it on, because it is huge. It's looking at everything that happened on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, it is kind of big. The reason I took it on is because I love the newspaper. I read the newspaper every day, and I think that how our lives are reported and discussed within the newspaper is infinitely fascinating. So that I got to this idea that there must be some kind of reflection on the everyday contained within newspapers that would enlighten us about the flu.
Why did you see sound as the most effective medium to convey this very 20th century and in some ways 21st century story as well? Because there are overlaps, which I'd like to discuss in a moment.
Yeah, I thought that I wanted to have something that was delivered every day, similar to a newspaper. I wanted to have something that wasn't physical, similar to a virus, something that was easily communicable and spreadable, a little bit like a virus. So there are reasons why it's a non-physical thing.
And how did you go about structuring it? Why go for the day-to-day approach, the everyday? Because I'm sure there must have been other options that you would have considered.
I think to kind of reiterate how problematic and difficult it was during the influenza epidemic, that the only way to talk about that is to talk about it every single day.
And did the scale of the project ever intimidate you at any stage when
it
you were trying to put
time.
This together?
It does now, yeah.
What makes it so intimidating?
Well, there's just the vastness. I mean, to get to none of the reports are more than 5 minutes long. And to get to that 5 minutes to create those scripts, there's quite a lot of articles that are left out. And I haven't invented anything. I have re-edited some of the scripts, but some of the articles, but I haven't invented anything. So in order to really convey the trauma of what people suffered, it had to be the way that it is.
And what were the overlaps which came out? Because just listening to it, I mean, as I mentioned, the Black Death, obviously I wasn't around at that time, but certainly when you compare this influenza epidemic to recent pandemics that we've had, Ebola, AIDS. I mean, were you surprised at the overlap, that even though you've got this separation of history, there's still this sense of the ever-present?
I wasn't real surprised about that overlap. The thing that surprises me, or the thing that is a bit scary, is the atmosphere and the mood, because I think the mood of 1918, 1919 is not dissimilar to the mood that we're experiencing now. There's a lot of fear, there's a lot of anxiety, there's a lot of paranoia about what happens next in our world. And I think that was very clearly discussed and debated within 1918, 1919 in terms of the influenza epidemic.
Mm. Was there sensationalism in the coverage that you came across?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's sensationalism, but there's also censorship because the governments didn't want people to get that upset about what was really happening. And if you can imagine, there's one time where there were 300 bodies waiting to be buried in, just in Bethnal Green in 1 week. That's an enormous amount of people waiting to be buried. And if you multiply that across London, across Britain, across the world, that's a lot of people.
And in the time that we have available, which is very, very brief, I mean, the first audio soundtrack went out on the 1st of November with the rest to follow over the year. So what else are the listeners going to hear?
I can't possibly give that away.
But they'll be hearing ordinary people, survivors of that time, don't
they? Oh, yeah. So it continues in the vein that it has started, in that there are various newspaper articles. But what happens is that the statistics continue all the way through. It's really interesting, the way that statistics are used to describe what happened on the Spanish flu. But I think what happens also is that the stories become more personal and less generalized over the year.
And definitely worth listening to, history brought to life. But Jordan Baseman, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining me. And still to come in this hour, specialist chocolate from the depths of Ecuador. We'll also go through the weekend newspapers. Stay with us. Was an extract from Return to Jaipur, a work by the French-Lebanese composer and violinist Layali Shaker. Now, the depth and inventiveness of her compositions has propelled Layali to international success and made a definitive impression on the world of classical music and beyond. By drawing on the richness of her cultural heritage, Layali's work penetrates the senses with the power and strength of its immediacy. As listeners, we are drawn into a world suggestive of loss, yearning, and the possibility of hope. One of the many reasons why Layali has earned a massive following amongst music lovers. And I'm delighted to say that she now joins me in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Tell me a little bit about that piece. What inspired you to write it? What's the story?
So very specifically about Return to Jaipur. It's actually a part of my upcoming album, In a Rhyme. And the whole album is actually, it's more like a suite that is based on Arabic poetry. And I've actually learned the equivalent of it is in English, scansion. So it is based on the scansion of Arabic poetry, meaning the way that poetry sounds when pronounced, when spoken and declaimed.
So it's the rhythm of the spoken word.
Exactly, which is very preeminent in Arabic poetry. It's very important. And Return to Jaipur in specific is actually based on a poem by Badr Shakir Sayyab, who's an Iraqi poet, who's experienced exile throughout his life, and who comes actually from Jaipur, which is in Basra in southern Iraq. Badr Shakir Sayyab has been a pioneer in free verse poetry in the Arab world, and has also been persecuted for being a communist by the royalist regime at the time. So he's really a figure of the artist in exile, for his art, for his form, and also for his ideas. And this piece in particular is based on his poem, A Return to Jaipur, Alauda ila Jaipur.
And what fascinates me is the challenge of taking the rhythm of the spoken word, free-flowing word, and transcribing that to music. How do you replicate that? With great difficulty, I know.
So the idea of it came to me because there are quite a few treatises in Arabic literature about this, about the idea of how important the metric is in the poetry. And it came at a time when I was basically really lacking the presence of my native language in what I do, because I'm an instrumentist and I'm a composer and I do not use speech. I'm not a singer. So I really began missing this component, this essential component of my culture, which is the word, which is many times much more important and often more important than the music itself. We have poets that are local superstars. We have stadiums that are filled to hear poets read. So I have really missed that presence in my life, and I've started digging into poetry and thinking maybe like translating what the poetry means is not enough. Maybe what I miss is actually the way this poetry sounds. I think it's closer to its core and closer to its essence.
Well, you've done it beautifully, even for an outsider like myself, because you can get that sense of rhythm. But
yeah,
what also strikes me about the music is that, yes, you are a violinist, but it's the fact that you use the violin and also traditional Arab instruments as well, and it all fuses together beautifully.
Well, this is thank you. Well, this is exactly what I wanted. I really wanted to translate the essence of this poetry across, basically beyond language and beyond understanding, really using the music for what it is. Music is, at the end of the day, an art of the suggestion. It doesn't really paint a specific image. It just gives a feeling, or it just speaks to our intuition. And I really wanted the poetry to be able to do that as well.
Now, I read your website and you describe the violin as the wanderer's instrument. What makes you a wanderer? Because clearly there must be that wanderlust within you if the two have come together.
I just feel that the violin very specifically is an instrument that was not just my feeling. It's actually just historically the instrument has been claimed by so many cultures because it's so easy to transport, because it's fretless, and so it pairs with tempered music and then untempered music. For example, it's an instrument that is key to Carnatic music in India, and then it's key to Gypsy music. You see it all over Southern Europe and Eastern Europe. And of course, Italy, there's a big, big tradition in violin making. Of course, it's very it's omnipresent in classical repertoire, and then it's very present, and it's been very present in Arabic classical music as well, since the Egyptian Nahda, which is like the Arabic Renaissance music. So I just find that it's very interesting because it's a chameleon. The instrument in itself, it doesn't belong to one culture.
And that's a fascinating thing that's come out of what you've just said, because I almost get the impression that you're drawn to it because it takes you on a journey, not just through your culture, but the cultures of others, and journeys through time because of that history of the violin. It's how it's evolved as an instrument.
I really feel that it transcends a specific aesthetic. I think it really pairs well with any aesthetic, and it's just a concept that really fascinates me and makes it so easy to collaborate with musicians beyond this idea of just merely, you know, fusion or whatever you want to call it, but actually like real authentic dialogue.
And I'm fascinated that you've used the word collaborate, because I know as well that you're into jazz improvisation as well. So again, collaboration, but the need to really synchronize with your fellow performers. How do you do that? Because jazz and Arabic music seem so intrinsically different.
It's quite different. And I think it's actually beyond also jazz and Arabic music. For example, I just worked on a Baroque project, and I'm about to work on a Baroque project in May in London as well. So it's really about basically the concept of, for example, the concept of time, which is something I'm fascinated with. Like, different musicians from different cultures perceive time very differently and rhythm very differently. Of course, we're talking about tempered and untempered music. So basically music that is rooted in harmony, and then music that is rooted in modality. And it's all about trying to navigate these differences while also being aware that there are many similarities, and trying to use these similarities as, you know, the pivots or the base on which we start our dialogue, so that the dialogue is on equal grounds. So that's always a work in progress, even up until the day of the concert.
Never stops. Let's change tack slightly, because I know that you're very passionate about the work that you do with Syrian child refugees at the Ketamaya refugee camp in Lebanon. So how does music reach out and improve the lives of these youngsters? And more to the point, how does it help you connect with them?
So I've been working quite a lot with refugee children in Gadar Mayo, and then a few months ago I was also working in Mardin on the border of Turkey and Syria. And I really find music to be an extraordinary tool of expression and empowerment. You give children this basically this new tool where they feel that they have their own means of expression and their own means of empowerment. And instead of just giving it to them, you're just actually just exposing them to this possibility. And it's just met with so much enthusiasm. What I do normally is that we work on folk tunes, so tunes they maybe have heard from their parents. So there's this using music as a link to their personal histories, actually, to the history of their land. And there's also this idea of just being able to create something on the spot and being able to create it in collectivity. And the reward, you know, all, as human beings, we all need these little rewards to make us progress in life. And just by being able to create something, a song, a drawing that is inspired by music, just these little victories day after day is just very empowering for children.
Mm. How did that relationship begin? What was the trigger?
It's been different organizations just reaching out through like just different organizations in Lebanon and then Turkey and then the US as well. So it's been an ongoing process, and I also have quite a few other engagements for the year to come. Mm. So it's something that I strive to give time to.
Mm. And do you think that children are perhaps more receptive to music than adults because they don't go into it with a particular bias?
Yes.
They're very open.
They are extremely open. They're like sponges. They just learn everything so quickly, and they're so receptive and very enthusiastic. And so that's why the dialogue is so real. And there are no boundaries at all. We can do anything, we can experiment anything, and during that short course of time we have together, everything is permitted. So it's wonderful for them and for me.
Have you ever found, though, that sometimes that desire to absorb information, whilst it's great on the one hand, it can be a bit tiring because you're ready to move on to stage two and they're probably 10 steps ahead of you?
they're always 10 steps ahead. They're always like just focused on 1,000 things at a time. And then when you ask them to do something, they have it. They nail it right on the spot. So it's really...
So the pupils are teaching the teacher, not the other way around.
Yes, it's always like that.
I mean, you've seen the difference that it's made to the lives of these children, particularly those who are traumatised, because you said they're actually making music, perhaps writing things which have been suppressed or drawing things.
Yeah.
But do you think that it's only now that perhaps we're beginning to really understand the healing power of music and its ability to connect to people, particularly those who have suffered terrible things, either physically or things that they've witnessed?
I think that there's definitely a global awareness. For example, when I was working right now in Turkey, the music was just a part of a bigger program that was actually dedicated to circus arts. And you can just see from the organizers and the teachers and the children every day how impactful that is, how children just wake up every day very excited of coming to learn something new, a new skill physically, or even learning a new melody. Or it's just, it's a drive, and it gives them a renewed purpose. I think it's also the idea of the importance of feeling like you're learning a skill that you can use later. Mm. So it's just the idea of integrating a new skill and having also a new sense of home and belonging in a place you're not home.
Mm.
So this new home becomes starts giving you something new, and that's very essential. That's the only way you can grow roots anywhere else, actually.
Mm.
It's the way the place contributes to you, and you feel like you can contribute back to it.
Now, I wasn't exaggerating when I was talking about your reputation, because you're very young and you have got this astonishing reputation in the world of international music, which explains why you're very busy. And you said that you're working on an album, and are you also performing this evening as well?
Oh, yes. So we are the work on the album is over. So we're releasing the album, actually.
No last minute twitches or anything like that.
It's done. I have to accept it the way it is now in its current format.
So you are a perfectionist, a ruthless perfectionist.
So we're performing the album tonight. We're performing In a Rhyme, this suite of poetry tonight, with my band, Sarafond.
And where are you performing it?
We're performing as part of London Jazz Festival at Rich Mix at 8 p.m. So it's going to be myself plus four musicians, and we're going to just be spending an evening of reciting poetry and then playing music and talking about this poetry.
Mm. And that's interesting because obviously you'll have a very diverse audience, and so for some of them, they will never have experienced Arab poetry before, so this will be a bit of a first.
I hope so. I hope it will be a nice discovery.
How does that feel?
I'm very excited, actually, and I'm just very much looking forward to meeting audiences I haven't met before, and this this moment we get to share music together, so it's going to be beautiful.
And will there be the occasional traditional classical piece, or is it, nope, no classical tonight, it's purely...
There might be. There might be. I can't give away everything, but
Give us a name of, just give us a name of a composer, because they've got such huge bodies of work behind them.
Well, no, there will not be another composer. Actually, there will be. I will be performing some bits of my concerto I have written a year ago. So I'll be performing some bits of it, but it will be really intertwined with the rest of the music.
Well, you know, either which way, it's going to be a fabulous evening. But Layali Shaker, thank you so much for joining us in the studio.
Thank you for having me.
Good luck with tonight's show. Not that you need it, because you will be absolutely superb as always. We're going to play out now with an extract from your work, Relentless. Now it's time for our regular Sunday brunch feature called Weekend Reads. Each week, Georgina Godwin will speak to a different author about their latest work. This week, she met Sheila Parry. Now, as a strategic consultant to the likes of Adidas and Siemens, Sheila knows what makes a business tick. However, with UK workers having one of the lowest levels of job satisfaction in the world, how do businesses maintain their success? Well, Sheila's book, Take Pride, How to Build Organisational Success Through Your People, explores this very question, as she explained to Georgina.
When I started working for large organisations, they very often had opinion surveys, and they asked their staff why they liked working there or what their impressions of working there was. And there was this key question, which was, are you proud to work for this organisation? And people would score really highly in the pride factor, and then there would be other things that they weren't at all happy about in their workplace. And I began to think, well, how could that be? You know, how can you be proud to work somewhere but then maybe not speak your mind or not have a good experience at work? And then I spent years on that topic, really helping companies deliver on the promise that they make to their employees when they recruit them. Mm. And so the whole concept of pride has been a really constant theme, and you still hear people saying, we want our employees to be proud of what they do, to be proud to work here. But they don't actually unpick it to see, why would you be proud of working somewhere? Why would I be proud? There are very different motivations. Mm.
So as we say, that there are five key factors to that. So let's go through those. So the P of pride is purpose.
Yes, I mean, purpose is a very current theme in business, as you know. I have a couple of theories about why. I mean, I believe that everybody wants to find a purpose. It doesn't necessarily have to come from work at all, but it very often does. I mean, it's such a huge part of our lives. But purpose is very current because I think companies have had to prove themselves to a new generation of workers, a new generation of people who've been let down by corporations, let down by institutions that previously we trusted. And so purpose has been almost like a renaissance of trust in organisations. Mm. On the other hand, some companies are genuinely purposeful. Charities and third sector, a lot of companies that we all know about that are built for a very specific purpose. But it can mean very different things to organisations. And then you have to work out, well, what's my purpose in this organisation? It won't be the same for 10,000 people across a company.
Of course. And reputation is the next point.
Yes, reputation is very often the first thing you will know about a company. So there's a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy that the best known companies are the most aspirational employers. And I call them like the brand elite. There will always be some really great companies that people will always want to work for. But there's such a minority, and there are tens of thousands of people coming out of school and coming out of university who've never heard of most companies who need to find them. Mm. And so a company needs to build its reputation even if it hasn't got a huge brand budget. And the SME market and the middle-sized companies are really lacking in the space of trying to find the right people to join them. So everybody coming out of the mostly universities are applying for the same companies, and there's a big, big gap between the demand and the supply.
Mm. And then, of course, there's integrity.
This is the core. I mean, you know, there's a fortuitous word, mnemonic, but integrity is absolutely at the centre of the model for a very good reason, that it is the integrity of the brand, the integrity of the promise that matters. That is the day-to-day, the Monday to Friday reality of work. When you go into work, does anybody say good morning? Have you had a good weekend? Does anybody know that you maybe have a sick child or a sick parent? And these are the things that everybody can influence. The integrity of your brand, the integrity of your workplace culture is up to all of us to own. There's a great deal of theory that it has to be top down and nothing works unless the leader is a people person. But I truly believe that we can all influence the workplace, you know, from our own behaviours. And we join companies that we feel at one with. Mm. And we stay with companies that we feel at one with.
And the final two are direction and energy.
Yes, and very, very tied up together. Direction is very often delivered top down, but not everybody wants to climb Everest. I mean, you know, you can have a very aspirational vision for your company, but there are people in your organisation who will go with you, and there are people who will need to stay the same for a few years. Things are going on in their lives, for example. So fulfilling people's personal directional needs is very, very important for leaders to understand, I think, to look at the people in front of them and not just look at the kind of strategy. Mm. And then energy. We all need to be fired up. We all need to have inspiration. We all need to have well-being. And that comes on all different levels, you know, which I go into in the book in quite some detail, because people don't really talk about spiritual energy very much. They'll talk about health and well-being. But really what's going on in your mind and where you're finding your ideas from is crucially important for companies to be sustained and survive.
Why do you think that there's such a low level of job satisfaction in the UK now compared to other countries?
I think it's possibly people are measuring the wrong thing. I mean, employee engagement has been my work label for several years, coming from an internal communications background and working to really help people understand what's going on in an organisation. And I think that the reasons behind employee engagement aren't unpicked. So people can be very, very proud of the companies they work for. But as I said, there are these sort of realities of the workplace that simply aren't being addressed. Mm. I do think there's obviously a kind of, we don't know what's going to happen. There's a sort of low level of confidence, I think, in the future, certainly in business in this country.
Is that Brexit related? I mean, do we have a less trust for institutions now in 2018 than we have had previously?
I think we have more uncertainty. I think the trust in institutions is proven to be recovering, particularly in the corporations of the business sector, which is my sort of area. But I do think that not knowing where one is going is a huge source of dissatisfaction in the workplace. If you hear, for example, there's going to be restructuring, but you don't know in what way, in what direction, you know, there's a great deal of insecurity that happens in the workplace. And I think that's actually is happening to us in this country now with Brexit, and generally with an economy that started to recover and then has had another blip.
Mm. What you're really saying, I suppose, also is that it's people that's at the heart of this.
Yes, and it's so easy to say, and that is the difficult thing to actually deliver on. People are our greatest assets. I don't know a company who wouldn't say that. But actually proving that on a daily basis is a real challenge. It's a challenge I had to live up to as an employer myself. And I understand that those are they're very individual things you have to take into account. But I believe that you can know 10 people, you can know 100 people. We all know more than 100 people in our networks, on Facebook, in LinkedIn. And if you are an employer of many, many people, it is your duty to know as many people as you interface with. Mm-hmm. And I do think it's a challenge that leaders need to step up to, and many, many tiers of management in between. You know, companies are their hierarchies. They're not all democracies. And so there's a part in the book where I just give a few tips about how to be a good manager. You can Google it, but it's an integral part of the book, and individual behaviours affecting individual behaviours is the outcome I really hope for.
Yeah. And finally, who is the book aimed at?
Well, the first target audience really is people who have influence in organisational culture, leaders, entrepreneurs who are beginning to recruit people, who think that they've got a great idea and people will join them because they've got a great idea. But really, to keep them, they need to understand that not everybody is the leader and everybody has their own motivations that need to be fulfilled. But I do think there's a kind of, there's something in it for everybody. And that's what I'm finding with people reading the book. They're saying, can it work for me? Can I find my personal pride? And I very much hope they can. It's great to have a book, but I want the impact to be that people have a better time at work.
Okay, so that's, one of the book reviews for the day. But let's move on now to take a look at the weekend newspapers. I'm joined in the studio by Marie Billon. She is a journalist for French media. Welcome. Bonjour.
Bonjour.
And don't tell me we're going to discuss a subject that begins with a B and ends with a T. You didn't get it? The middle letter is X.
Brexit, of course. Yes, we cannot not talk about
the only
Brexit
game in town.
Today. Yeah, the only game in town. But today it's only also the only game in Brussels. So we learned recently, in a few minutes ago, that basically the EU 27 decided to go ahead with May's deal. So
a draft withdrawal plan.
The draft withdrawal and also the declaration of intention, the political declaration of intention. Everything's been so settled apparently in Brussels. So drama averted in Brussels.
At the moment.
At the moment, yes, of course. Doesn't mean that drama is averted in the UK. But it's very, very interesting. I was stricken last week. At the start of last week, you could see that in London, the famous flegme of the British was completely lost. Everybody was running around saying there's going to be a leadership challenge, there's going to be this, it's going to be that. Mm. And then on the news channel, you could see Brussels. Everything was so calm. Michel Barnier giving the document very calmly and amicably to Tusk. And then flashback to London, everybody's running around. It was very, very fun to see that. Of course, at the end of last week, it was a bit different. And Le Monde, the French newspaper, is focusing on that, on the fact that for the first time in the negotiations, some of the EU 27 have started bickering. And it's true that until...
Excuse me, did I hear that correctly? Bickering? Perish the thought.
Well, yes, apparently enough. No one's perfect, but that was, of course, evident. But it's true that the front of Michel Barnier being the representative of the wall of the 27 make it look like everybody was okay, everybody was happy with everything and okay with each other. And then as soon as Michel Barnier took a step down, basically said, so now I did my part, it's now to the EU 27, the head of governments and head of states, to do their job, it started to unravel a little bit.
And we had a sense of it, didn't we? Because we had the Spanish who basically threatened not to show up at this summit unless their demands relating to Gibraltar were honoured by the British. Now, Mrs. May has said, yeah, fine, don't worry. But again, that feeds fire to the Brexiteers at home, because they will turn around and say, there you go, she's making concessions to them again.
Well, surprisingly enough, that's the take that the Sunday Telegraph is taking today.
So, a very pro-Brexit newspaper, it has to be said.
Absolutely, yes. So yeah, it's true that basically yesterday she decided to go ahead and promise to Spain that no future deal between the UK and the EU will automatically involve Gibraltar. There's going to be, one-to-one negotiation with Madrid when it goes to Gibraltar.
No hard borders there with Gibraltar.
Yeah, so they're not really, happy neighbours over there. But it's true that it's the dynamism changed a bit in Brussels. And yesterday, with this letter that was sent by the UK ambassador to the EU saying everything is okay with Gibraltar, means that today has been smooth sailing in a way in Brussels. So they might be able to show the calmness of Brussels again. When in the UK, of course, it's going to be in French we say a decapitated hens running around. I don't know if there's the equivalent in the UK. It's just basically people running frantically everywhere with no direction whatsoever.
Yeah, it's called just headless shouting. Chickens in the
headless
United
chickens.
Kingdom.
Yes, of course. Yes, that's absolutely. So, and because of course, what's happening now is that the EU27 did their job, but the Parliament in the UK has to do its job as well. And the concession, seen as a concession of May yesterday, might have not have made the deal more palatable to the Brexiteers. It might not have helped the anti-Brexit either. So it's going to be a frantic week, I think, in the UK and from France, because it was Le Monde we based our discussion on. It's very interesting to see how the UK politics is going down at the moment with Brexit. We look at that with bewilderment because we saw the UK as, you know, a very poised country with a stable democracy and respect in a way within the walls of Westminster or within Whitehall in general. And we see that it's going so bad. Again, Le Monde is a French newspaper. A few months ago, perhaps Macron could have been able to say, well, it's going better with me. But of course, it's not going too well. I think that's going to be the second topic we're going to discuss.
Yeah,
it's
that's right.
Because as well.
Yeah, but again, a European theme, so they are connected. And that this time you've chosen the Sunday Times newspaper, page 29. And this is a reference to the disturbances that we saw in Paris during the weekend. In fact, we cover the aftermath in our news bulletins that there has been a condemnation from Monsieur Macron. But again, things go much deeper than simply words.
Yes, absolutely. So yesterday, basically, we knew that the Yellow Vest, basically, have started a movement in earnest last weekend. There were barrage on the road. There were demonstrations. It died down a little bit during the week, but it started again less powerfully than last weekend. But it started again yesterday. And the authorities basically decided that the Champs-Élysées, which is basically the main posh and touristy road in Paris.
It's a very expensive street.
Very expensive street. Was basically out of reach to the demonstrators. They were supposed to be at the foot of the Champs-Élysées, on the Champ de Mars for the demonstration. So they thought that it's going to be all right on the Champs-Élysées. We're just going to contain it on the Champ de Mars. But of course, they decided to go on the Champs-Élysées. And everything was there, meaning that the demonstrators were able to built barricades. They took, chairs from the cafes, the railing from everything that was on the street, basically. So it started to get very, very violent.
And people were talking about revolutions, those images of the late 1960s, except that there weren't that many students, or so they may have been students, but it's still that same revolutionary fervour, the call for it, and again, estrangement from government.
Yes, so there's this thing, the barricades, of course, and the throwing of the stones that makes the street make it think, of course, of the 60s. The difference, very important difference, is that it looks like very much that in the 60s it was left-wing students that were doing the demonstration. Yesterday it was fueled by right-wing ultras who started really the rioting. I mean, it was a demonstration and then it went into a rioting. And according to the demonstration and all the pictures that was sent on the Twitter, for example, when you can see the faces of prominent, far right representative, you could see that there's a political recuperation by the far right to this kind of demonstration. So we're doing a lot about that because, for example, Marine Le Pen, the chief of the far-right party, the
National
French
Front, yeah.
Well, the ex-National Front is
the French
rally, something like that.
Yeah, they keep on fragmenting.
Yeah, me too. I always forget about that. But basically, she said, why are we not allowed to go on Champs-Élysées, which a lot of people understand that just go to the Champs-Élysées. So there's a big of fake news, in a way, in the Twitter feeds. But there's also the thing that the far-right is really taking hold of this movement. And that's why basically last week there were more than 100,000 people demonstrating on the street. There was only 20,000 this week because during the week we saw this political recuperation happening.
But this is interesting. You use the word movement. If you talk about a movement, there's an assumption that there is a leader or some sort of a hierarchy. Mm. Now, where is it? Because, again, the commentators who've been following this, they've said, well, OK, it may have the backing of the right, but the right hasn't actually said, OK, we're now going to take this over and impose an existing structure on this already.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's a headless movement. There's no chief to the movement. It's really a popular movement in a way. That's why, basically, it might have been possible, area by area, department by department, to be infiltrated by the far right. If it was more organized, it would have been easier to, you know, flesh out people who didn't have good intention. But because it was a completely popular movement, it's a bit more complicated. And the non-organization is the force of the movement in a way as well, because otherwise the government could have been able to say, oh, it's just a political demonstration, it's good to have, you know, discussion in the country, but as soon as you go to violence, it's not right. So it would have been able to put a stop to it. Whereas if you are basically facing the French people, of course it's much, much less popular to send the police against them and tear gas and all that. So that the fact that it's a headless movement makes it much more complicated for the authority to deal with that.
And it's quite interesting from Macron as well, because internationally he's seen as this young thrusting statesman. Yes. But what people on this side of the channel forget is that he does have problems. This is one manifestation of it, but also there are some people who have left the En Marche movement. They don't want anything to do with this government. They've walked away from it. Yes. And so they're sort of bobbing around in the sea looking for somewhere else to go. But we're not just talking about minor players. Some of them are quite key.
Well, I think you're thinking about the mayor of Lyon who decided to leave the government. So he didn't really, you know, say I'm leaving the En Marche movement and I don't believe in Macron anymore. But what he did said that, although he didn't say it, you know, directly. And it's true, there's a lot of discontentment about the Macron policies and the fact that he was, you know, was supposed to be socially advanced, but now it's a bit less, it's seen as more the president of the rich. That's why it's being seen as.
Okay, Marie, we have to leave it there. But look, we've had a really exhaustive journey through some of the newspapers, giving us a good sense of what is happening on the continent of Europe. But Marie Bion, thank you so much for joining me. You're listening to Sunday Brunch. And finally, deep in the Ecuadorian rainforest, Susana Cardenas and her team are collecting something very valuable: cacao. It's heritage cacao that regenerates vintage plantations, preserves rainforests, and empowers local communities. Well, she brought some samples for Georgina Goodwin to try.
Cardenas Chocolate is my new venture, which it came along with my recent studies at Cambridge University, and it's beyond only chocolate. It really has an impact on regeneration of these vintage cacao trees that we have in Ecuador and preservation of the rainforest. And the most important is empowering the people who cultivate them. Those are the main three pillars of my new chocolate venture, Cardenas Chocolate. And of course, flavor has to be beautiful.
Tell me about empowering those people. How has this helped create a sustainable future?
It has been a journey, not only for me, but for the people I'm working with, because somehow they were forgotten. They were forgotten over the years. It has been a challenge also, not only to recognize these areas that have a history with cacao cultivation, but also to empower them, to make them feel proud of what they got, and to really say, yes, I do own this plantation that up to the 1920s were one of the big producers of cacao in Latin America. The last 400 years, Ecuador has had a history with cacao cultivation, with a variety called Arriba Nacional. So we grace the tables of all these most beautiful, noble tables in Europe and also in the United States. So up to the 1920s, we had a very good life in general, people who live out of cacao. But in the 1920s came a disease that almost decimated most of the cacao plantations in Ecuador. So what happened, of course, had a strong impact on the people who live there and the economy of my country. But through research, through investigation, we have found some survivals of those trees. And it is in an area where my family comes from my mother's side. I remember her telling me of those or some names that now have discovered that she was familiar to, because her father also used to share those names of these haciendas with her. So it has been a wonderful moment to discover those trees that have been there for generations, that were survivors of this disease. And our intention is to bring back the glory of those trees again.
And there's a whole environmental message going on, and a biodiversity message too.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, now things in cacao have changed a lot because of there's a lot of... It's good how technology empowers also people and help you to recuperate genetics in cacao. But imagine finding a beautiful jewel that have been there and no one has known that it has been there, hidden. And suddenly you discover it and you know there's something precious, precious in flavor. But beyond flavor, it's the history that is behind that. Who has been cultivated that and what was it before? And the ability to bring back that again alive is something magnificent to me.
Now, you mentioned the words beautiful jewel, and that's exactly what the packaging looks like. You have these beautiful jewel boxes with, I presume, chocolate in it. Tell me what's special about the packaging.
Right. When I say that I curate this collection, of course, it's beyond only cacao. And one of the ethos of what I'm continuing with my venture is also empowering local communities. What you see here are the first two are textiles that up to the 1980s in my region, in Manabí, Ecuador, there were 40 workshops of these people, like handcraft people, making these beautiful textiles in a town next to Montecristi, where we originally strongly called Panama Hats. So the finest one come from Montecristi. So next to this area, there is a small town that they also weave textiles made out of this material. But what happened in the 1980s? Plastic arrived. So they couldn't compete with plastic. So most of them were closed down. But now, it seems like it's a moment again, because environmentally, there is so much pressure to protect the environment. So now their work is demanded again. This is the reason why we're using this material that is coming from this little town with these wonderful people I've been working with. For me, that's empowerment.
Susanna, I think it's time for us to try it, surely.
Of course. So
now,
please.
Now, is there a special way of tasting chocolate? You warned me to have some water ready to cleanse my palate.
You need to cleanse your palate. So when you eat this kind of chocolate, you apply all your senses. So I firstly invite you to take a piece of it.
Thank you.
So
I'm unwrapping this. It's in gold foil. And as I say, it comes out of this beautiful box. It is dark, dark chocolate, and it's got horizontal lines going across it. And I'm just going to take a little nibble.
Wait,
or should
please,
I smell
wait,
it first?
Yes. So when I say that we apply all our senses, it's truly, we do apply all our senses. It's a sensorial experience. It's a journey. I want you to take you on a journey to these magnificent trees in my region, in Manabí, Ecuador. So you see the scent of it, the fragrance. It's very delicate and soft. So you see it. You see it's beautiful and uniform. Then you cut it into half. That's a snap. Instantly, you smell it again. Mm. And the secret of it, take half piece of it, and you will put it into your mouth, chew it a little bit, and just let it melt.
Mm-hmm.
Just let it melt.
It is just extraordinary. From the moment you sniff it, you could be there in the rainforest, couldn't you? There's that slightly sort of damp, musty, deep, rich smell coming through. And now, this wonderful taste, which isn't that horrible kind of sickly sweet you get with commercial chocolates. It's something much, much more subtle coming through. Oh, it's very delicious.
This is delicate. To me, is just a rain of hazelnuts, a touch of flowers and some honey. So it's so velvety and delicate and feminine. I would say it's quite feminine as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's an 80%, but this is the way a good chocolate should be.
Yeah. Yeah, that is just so delicious. So, I mean, just to go back to the wine analogy, there are sort of tasting notes like wine, aren't there? I mean, that's how you do it.
Well, this revolution in chocolate nowadays is happening the same way that wine was 30 years ago. So that's the beauty of cacao. That's the beauty of what cacao can allow you to be, or to get, or reach. And this is our aim, to put our chocolate at the same level of wine, because we have all the history of cacao cultivation in my country, and the way we do it as well, and why we do it, that is beyond only flavor. Of course, flavor has to be beautiful, but it's beyond that.
Susana Jardines talking chocolate with Georgina Goodwin. And you can get some of Susana's chocolate for yourself at Moises Stevens in London. And that's all for this edition of Sunday Brunch here in London. It was produced in studio managed by George McDonough. Our researcher was Mariana Lacrasta. Coming up, we have Joey Dossick on the Midori House Sessions. But from me, Juliet Foster, goodbye.